Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. For today's show, we're focusing on drought. The State Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife held a hearing this week on the drought. Eduardo Garcia is the committee chair.
I want to welcome our witnesses to the hearing and thank them for coming before the committee to discuss how California should respond to the drought. We are in the middle of our second dry year in a row and on track to see our fourth driest year on record. This feels like deja vu, and I'm sure you all would agree. We just came out of our last drought in 2017, California's more severe drought on record, and here we are again. We all agree that water is essential for public health to meet basic needs, to drive our economy, and to sustain our diverse natural resources. When drought occurs, everyone and everything is adversely affected. The 2012 through 16 drought exposed challenges in meeting our promise to ensure access to safe and affordable drinking water for all Californians. It had crippling effects on our agricultural sector. It dried up rivers, and that in turn adversely impacted our commercial fisheries. And finally, it exacerbated wildfire season. It's imperative that we do everything that we can to respond to and mitigate these drought conditions. There's too much at stake not to take action. I want to thank everyone for participating in this important discussion. I want to hear about what we've learned from the last drought and what we are doing right now, what we need to do this summer, next year, and beyond to become more drought resilient. We have a historic opportunity with a budget surplus and pending bond proposals to make down payments to alleviate the impacts of future droughts. Let's take advantage of it so that we can ease the impacts of the drought on our communities, farms, fisheries, and natural resources.
Janine Jones, Interstate Resources Manager at the California Department of Water Resources, gave perspective from her department.
So we want to start out in coordination with my colleagues at the State Water Resources Control Board, talking about the report to the legislature that was recently authored by the California Natural Resources Agency, and talking about some of the background from that. As Ms. Ehlers mentioned, the issue of drought in California is certainly not a new thing. We've had lots of experience in dealing with droughts. And in the last drought, we were significantly challenged by the record-breaking nature of that drought. Very warm temperatures, extremely dry hydrology, and some new challenges in the form of impacts related to that warming trend, including specifically things like wildfire, for example, and also other challenges associated with first ever zero water allocations to agricultural contractors of the Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Project, which in turn introduced other issues such as increased groundwater pumping that in some cases affected domestic, privately owned domestic wells, and also identifying a number of water rights challenges associated with managing in those conditions. So the CNRA report looked at these items that were specified in the legislative direction, and it was the second time that we had a statewide drought emergency proclamation for drought, the first time the state ordered mandatory urban water use reduction, and working in some really unprecedented areas for us, such as the assistance for the small water systems and especially the private well owners whose wells were dewatered during the drought. Following that drought, during and following, we saw a number of new initiatives to address some of these issues, including enactment of the SGMA legislation, increased attention to water conservation, very important funding support for small water systems, because one of the lessons learned from this drought was the need to plan and act sooner in response to dry conditions, because things such as responding to small water system outages and managing for things that take long lead time to develop really do require starting earlier, getting better data, and being prepared to respond earlier to impacts that we may not have quite seen in a similar fashion in prior droughts. For example, speaking of, things that we should be doing earlier is having the data collection and forecasting to be able to support these actions that we need to take, whether it is contracting for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to be able to upgrade and improve their facilities and respond to water conditions, or to be able to deliver emergency assistance to these small water systems. Out of this, we've identified a number of initiatives to move forward in the data and forecasting area, and also really working on close coordination among our agencies. And one good example of coordination among our agencies was the work that was done in the last drought with the very close coordination of the State Water Project and Federal Central Valley Project operations with the state and federal fishery agencies and with the State Water Resources Control Board, which had a number of challenges to address in terms of managing water rights with limited data and under these extremely dry hydrologic conditions. How does this inform our response and the actions we're taking in the current drought? We've had now a second dry year, very dry in much of the state, about half of average precipitation for many parts of the state. And we are in fact seeing stream flows in our major Sierra Cascade river basins that are so important for urban and agricultural supplies, actually tracking below or at the levels we saw in the two driest years of the last drought in 2014 and 2015, which is certainly something that gives my colleagues at the State Water Resources Control Board pause, because they have to administer the water rights under these very challenging circumstances. And also pointing out the effect of long-term warming in the climate system that we have been seeing. There's really been a noticeable change since in this century as compared to droughts in prior centuries, with the impact of warming conditions, a lower runoff efficiency factor, meaning that even if we get a significant amount of rainfall, a little better than average, let's say in the next water year, we may still be dealing with dry conditions in the next year because more water is being lost to the system. And therefore, we really do have to proactively plan for what if next year is dry. Some of the things that we at DWR have been doing on the State Water Project side, streamlining the water transfer process for people who want to use our facilities to move water, preparing a drought contingency plan and sharing that with the State Water Resources Control Board and Fish and Wildlife, updating our information collection about reporting of dry private wells so that we could help provide assistance to these folks as we see these conditions development. And recently, we submitted a report to the legislature with recommendations on increased technical and other assistance for these small water systems and rural communities that we know from past experience have been so adversely affected during prior droughts, because large urban water agencies tend to be able to have the resources and the capacity to manage well to meet their customers' needs because they have a large ratepayer base and can afford the investments in reliability, which is not necessarily the case for systems that only have a few hundred connections.
Our news brief is coming up next. We do continue the discussion on drought in segment three. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today from the California Farm Bureau. Flower farmers report historically high demand for their blooms heading into Mother's Day. Growers and marketers say during the COVID-19 pandemic, many people have sent flowers to friends and loved ones to express feelings they haven't been able to express in person. As restrictions ease, people in the flower business say they expect demand to remain strong because people will reschedule weddings and other events postponed due to the pandemic. The newly announced America the Beautiful initiative will focus on six areas to support collaborative conservation efforts across the country. Stephanie Ho has more.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says there are six areas the new America the Beautiful initiative will address.
First, rewarding the voluntary conservation efforts of ranchers, farmers, and forest owners. Second, partnering with nature-deprived communities to create parks and open spaces.
Third would be supporting tribally-led conservation and restoration priorities, while fourth would be expanding wildlife habitat.
Fifth, increasing access for outdoor recreation. And sixth, creating jobs by investing in restoration and resilience.
The new report outlines the government's vision for a voluntary effort to conserve 30% of the country's land and waters by 2030.
This report calls on all of us across the country to unite around conserving America's lands and water. USDA looks forward to working with our federal partners, but most importantly, working with states, tribes, local communities, producers, and landowners, and many, many others to make this happen.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Efforts continue to provide COVID-19 vaccines to California farm employees. Farmers and ranchers have been scheduling clinics at their individual farms to supplement those organized by farm groups. With vaccines now more widely available, the groups say they are working to encourage vaccine use. For example, the Farm Employers Labor Service will host a webinar next week to inform farm employees about vaccine effectiveness and safety. Supplies of broilers and their products are lower than a year ago. Demand is growing and prices are rising. Gary Crawford has this report.
And now, Clara Cluck sings again. Oh boy, of course, Clara and the broiler industry are in what is developing into an interesting time, from the farms up through the nation's grocery stores and now restaurants.
You're looking at increased demand. At the same time, you're looking at relatively tight supplies.
Making for a very good price situation for producers. This from Agriculture Department Livestock Analyst Shale Shagham. First, on the supply side, things are getting a little tight. Shagham says broiler production in the first 3 months of this year, down 2% from the same time frame a year ago.
And that follows lower production during the entire second half of 2020. So you're walking in with lower production. You're also looking at very tight stocks. At the end of March, total broiler stocks were down about 21% from 2020, with breast meat down about 10% and wings down about 31%.
This at a time when restaurants and hotels are opening up a little more now. It's getting to be outdoor grilling season and all, so tight supplies and higher demand causing a big run-up in wholesale prices for chicken. For example, whole birds.
The national composite broiler price, which is what USDA uses as its benchmark price, we're talking about $1.05 per pound compared to about 60 cents a year ago.
Or about a 75% increase. Skinless breast meat, boneless, up about 56%.
And one of the prices that's been getting a lot of interest is the price of wings, which are currently $3 a pound compared to 96 cents a pound last year.
Well over 200% increase. So right now, broiler prices are very high.
That may provide incentives to expand production. But at the same time, you are looking at concerns about increased feed prices.
Yes, corn and soybean prices are soaring. Feed is the main cost of raising broilers. Nonetheless, Shagham says
there are going to be opportunities for producers to look at expansion.
In fact, Shagham says by the time 2021's over, broiler output will top 2020 production, but not by very much. The last USDA forecast had production up not even 0.5%, with average prices up almost 16% from last year. Those figures may change, though, with the new forecast coming May 12th. Okay, sing, Clara, sing. No, no, change my mind. Don't sing, Clara, don't sing. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
As consumers begin to prepare for seasonal celebrations and backyard gatherings, Be Sweet Citrus of Fowler reports a strong supply of lemons to help meet continued demand for springtime promotions. Be Sweet Citrus Director of Communications Monique Bienvenu says, from flavorful dressings to sweet lemonade, lemons are a staple ingredient to many festive recipes. That's your news brief for today. We continue our focus on drought right after this.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
We continue now with the State Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife hearing on the drought. The committee heard from Eric Ekdahl, Deputy Director of the Division of Water Rights at the State Water Resources Control Board.
To follow Janine's statements, I'd like to offer a few kind of high-level overviews of challenges and successes and future areas where we want to focus on improvement for this drought as well as future droughts that could occur. As Janine highlighted during the 2012 to 2016 drought, we had a number of challenges within the Division of Water Rights. We issued curtailment notices or notices of water unavailability to over 9,000 water right holders throughout the state. These water right holders ranged in priority from about 1902 to the present and affected millions of acre feet of potential water diversions from our state's surface water systems. Along with those curtailment notices came an unprecedented number of site inspections. And while enforcement isn't always a popular word in some areas, it's also an important component in making sure that the state's water rights system is followed and that people are complying with the curtailment notices when they are issued. We also issued a number of what's referred to as temporary urgency change petitions, and these are petitions to modify permit terms or requirements when conditions may be unavoidable or unforeseeable and are really needed on kind of emergency conditions. We did a number of TUCPs in the broader Bay Delta watershed, but also other watersheds throughout the state, including the Russian River. We also adopted a number of very successful in-stream flow emergency regulations. These were primarily focused on anadromous fish habitat in Mill Deer and Antelope Creek, which are tributaries to the Sacramento, as well as four small tributaries to the Russian River. And these were successful in ensuring kind of minimal, what we sometimes refer to as belly scraping flows, to ensure that there's just enough water to kind of prevent loss of entire cohorts of certain brood classes of fish. And although it was not directly within the Division of Water Rights, the Delta Watermaster developed and executed a voluntary drought agreement for water users in the Delta that ultimately resulted in an approximately 25% reduction in overall water diversions from surface Delta waters. There were a number of successes, as I've highlighted, the notices of water unavailability. It was the first time in about 40 years that the division had issued that scope and scale of curtailment notices. That was a significant lift for the division, but ultimately one that was fairly successful. The emergency in-stream regulations were also successful, and the number of enforcement and inspections over a two-year time period, we did about 2,200 inspections and site visits compared to a normal year where we might have between 50 and 100. That came with additional staff resources to help us do that, and it was a significant lift, but ultimately effective in ensuring that the board's curtailment notices were followed or observed. We also had a number of challenges, and some of these challenges continue. Sacramento River temperature was a challenge in the previous drought. I think it remains a bit of a challenge this year as well, although the coordination and communication between our state and federal partners has markedly improved, and we look forward to continue to work with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and DWR in kind of managing just broader water releases from project operations to ensure temperature, although from Shasta, it's largely the CBP or U.S. Bureau of Reclamation that's responsible for those releases. And one of the challenges and kind of long-term issues that we've noted in the previous drought and continue to observe our timeliness in terms of data. Water rights data is reported currently up to 18 months after it was actually diverted, which raises challenges for how timely we can kind of observe and compile and understand water use in a quasi real-time basis. To address some of these challenges, we recently developed a report called the Water Rights Drought Effort Review, or WARDER report, that involved reaching out to a number of stakeholders to essentially ask them what worked well during the previous drought, what didn't, what are the areas for improvement. And from those 24 entities, there were over 500 unique recommendations, but they all kind of fell in within four broad categories. Outreach and communication was cited by every single participant, and that's something that the division is specifically focusing on this year and this drought. Data and accounting were also identified by almost every participant, and citing areas where we could share data earlier and have better kind of QA/QC data. There were legal and policy uncertainties. I think that those still remain in many respects. And then also coordination just between our state partners and our federal partners as well. And that's, again, an area that we're actively improving upon and focusing on currently. I think with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Darren Polhemus.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Darren Polhemus. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Drinking Water at the State Water Board. I wanted to focus today largely on our response for water systems. During the last drought, there were a lot of systems that performed admirably, largely our large systems. We have 400 water systems that we consider to be large and deliver the bulk of the water to the largest population in the state. However, we also have over 2,900 small water systems in the state, an incredible number, and they range in a lot of diversity, many of them under-resourced and in poor, disadvantaged communities. And they, as Ms. Eller stated, often suffer the most in conditions like these. So focusing on the lessons we learned from the last drought, four kind of areas I wanted to touch on. One of them is we're this year and under this condition starting to perform early assessments associated with how the water systems are performing. Specifically, well monitoring, understanding the levels of water in their wells so that we can address the situation before they actually have dry wells on their hands and maybe even pulled air into their pumps and damaged their equipment, which obviously creates a much more catastrophic failure than just low water flows. And so that, along with understanding water systems that pull from reservoirs and have intakes in those reservoirs, many small systems do that. And it's not that the reservoir has to go empty before their intake is above the water surface. And so monitoring the level as reservoirs move down, and they're greatly depleted this year, coming into this year at the end of the wet season. So it's super critical that we be able to monitor those and anticipate ahead of time if we're going to need to take emergency actions along with the water system to try to make sure that they maintain their water flow. Another very important area that we saw in the last drought was domestic well failures. And we have already updated or increased the technical assistance provider money that we provide to several of our non-governmental partners that work in this space with us to assist private domestic well owners. And so that program is getting ready to take off, as I'm sure we happen. We still have dry wells from the last drought, water systems that are individual private domestic wells that have not recovered and are still in the program. And the program has basically continued to run. And now we're just amping it up a little bit more to anticipate an increase there, unfortunately. Thirdly is water quality of standby wells. During the interim period between the droughts, we've had several new maximum contaminant levels and other contaminating events come into play that weren't in the last drought. Specifically, 1-2-3 TCP has impacted a large number of drinking water wells in the San Joaquin Valley and some in Southern California. And then we have the PFAS contamination as well. There's not a regulatory limit there, but there is legislation about public notification, and most water systems are trying to limit their population's exposure to those chemicals by taking wells offline and not serving that water. That, of course, removes a resource that they were counting on heading into this drought. And so one of our priorities here is to make sure we communicate with water systems that as they plan to bring back those type of wells, that they plan now for making sure they're installing the necessary treatment to maintain water quality as they bring that standby well back. And we're committing to work with them to make that happen and prioritize our resources as well to make sure we're permitting those and getting those sources back online ahead of other work that we would normally be doing. And finally, Eric mentioned the curtailment orders that happened last year or last drought. Previously, we had 22 of those where we issue a corollary building moratorium or connection moratorium to make sure that the water systems are not adding further capacity demands as they're under curtailment and just trying to meet health and safety flows. We're preparing to continue to do that as we did last time as curtailments are necessary and to follow through.
We wrap up our focus on drought right after this sponsor message.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
At the Assembly Committee meeting this week, Rachel Ehlers with the Legal Analyst's Office gave a review of what the state did during the last drought. Here are her comments.
And I think my task here is to provide a brief review of how the state responded during the last drought, because obviously that can provide a lot of context as we hear, as the chair said, deja vu all over again, find ourselves in facing similar conditions. So starting on page one of that handout, you know, droughts are nothing new in California. We did face a significant drought recently. It lasted from 2012 through 2016, although some might say it actually started in 2007, and we just had one wet year in the middle in 2011 that broke it up. But that drought was really significant in a lot of ways. It was between 2012 and 2015, the driest four-year stretch on record in California, consecutive years. And 2014 was the third driest year on record. And those dry conditions and lack of precipitation were really compounded by also historically high temperatures. 2015 and 2014 were respectively the highest 2 years, hottest 2 years on record in California. And of course, we know that warm temperatures exacerbate dry conditions. They both increase demand for water, for irrigation, for agriculture, as well as in urban settings. And they also decrease snowmelt runoff because of evaporation and drier soils that soak up that water. So really a difficult combination of high temperatures and lack of precipitation. So the drought impacted sectors all across California in many different ways, urban communities, rural communities, agriculture, our environment. I know that your third panel has really stellar representatives who will go into the impacts for each of those sectors specifically. So I think I'll skip over trying to discuss those since you'll get those in your third panel. So turning to page two of our handout, this summarizes how the state spent money to respond to the last drought. As you can see, it was a total of $3.4 billion in state fundings spread across 4 different years. And you can see that the biggest category there was for water supply, $2.2 billion. And those were really for bigger, longer term projects intended to increase the state's resilience for future droughts. They didn't really, those types of big long term projects don't really help in the middle of a drought because they do take a long time to permit, to attain financing, to construct and get underway. So that bigger category hopefully will help us now, several years later, as we're facing another drought, but really probably didn't provide too much relief in the midst of the last drought. Now that's different from the emergency response categories you see here, which really were spending to try and address and ameliorate pressing urgent conditions, things like wells going dry, emergency drinking water needs, dead and dying trees that needed to be removed, fires breaking out, so that were kind of attributed directly to being worse because of the drought. And then water conservation activities, which you see there, significant expenditures as well, I think kind of check both categories. They both can help reduce demand and respond to immediate pressing drought conditions, but then also have ongoing results and assistance if things like removing turf and lawn in front yards or replacing toilets or showerheads with more efficient fixtures. That can help reduce water demand on an ongoing basis. And we see that. We see that urban per capita water use now, it remains less than it was in 2013 before the last drought. So we see that that has had ongoing implications. And then the final category of spending their environmental protection probably could also have fallen under the emergency response header, frankly, because a lot of that spending, the majority of that spending was really in response to emergency conditions. Things like trucking fish downstream, rescuing fish from hatcheries or streams where conditions had degraded, addressing human-wildlife conflict from wildlife coming down, you know, out of the hills in search of food because of dry conditions. So that was also kind of emergency response. In looking at these expenditures, the water supply up top was really primarily bond funding. You will recall that Prop 1 passed in 2014, so in the midst of the drought. So those big expenditures were primarily capital, primarily supported by bonds. Whereas in contrast, these other expenditures were primarily general fund. Of the total spending, general fund made up about $700 million, roughly about 20% of the total spending. And then there was also some support from some special funds when the state was able to kind of find the nexus between the requirements of a particular special fund and the activity it wanted to perform. But bonds typically are not well suited for that kind of emergency response because of they're typically for capital projects. So the next page 3 of the handout really covers what I just said verbally. So we'll skip ahead to page 4. Here you can see, I won't go into this in great detail, but just want to highlight for you that the drought response really involved a lot of state agencies, 14 different state agencies. These represent the departments that received a share of that $3.4 billion shown on the previous chart. So while certain agencies, like the ones you'll hear from today, Fish and Wildlife, DWR, and the State Water Board played really big roles, it's important here to see that other state departments also played a role and received funding in drought response. So it really highlights the need for coordination. I'll come back to that again in a moment. I also want to highlight for you that some of these different departments were funded for pretty similar efforts. You can see DWR, OES, and the Water Board were all received funding for addressing emergency drinking water needs. And similarly, CAL FIRE and OES both received funding for removing dead trees. So funding spread across a wide swath of state government here. Turning to page 5 of the handout, it wasn't just spending, it wasn't just money. There were also some significant policy changes enacted by the state in responding to the drought. Some of those were kind of an emergency short-term basis, either through executive order, emergency regulations, or the existing regulatory authority of different departments. These included statewide water conservation requirements for urban communities. The Water Board temporarily relaxed flow and water quality standards within the Delta and ordered and enforced that less water be diverted from the state's rivers and streams. The Fish and Game Commission closed some rivers and streams to fishing in order to protect fish in low water flow areas. And then the state also waived some state requirements, such as contracting and CEQA requirements in order to expedite some drought response activities. But in addition to those short-term activities, the state also, and primarily through the legislature, some through regulations, but primarily through legislation, adopted some ongoing permanent changes as well. And one of the biggest was the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which I know this committee is very familiar with, in 2014 to regulate the state's use of groundwater. There was also legislation enacted to authorize the state to consolidate small water systems that failed to meet drinking water standards, new standards for water efficiency in outdoor landscapes, as well as for conservation and planning in cities and urban communities. And then while it was adopted in 2018, which is obviously after the drought ended, the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, which provides $130 million annually to address drinking water issues, I think it's fair to say that was really motivated by some of the problems that were exacerbated and highlighted during the drought as well. That's obviously a significant ongoing policy change enacted by the legislature. So then turning to the final page of the handout, lessons to inform the current drought. I know this is something that the next administration panel is going to talk about as well, but some that really jumped out at us from this look back at what we did, how the state responded last time. And one of the first is what you all are doing already today, which is how can we be proactive rather than reactive? How can we take actions early or earlier before problems worsen and get ahead of what we think the problems might be and what we saw last time, rather than waiting until conditions get really dire? The second point here on the coordination and efficiency of state departments being really important. I think you'll hear about this in your next panel as well. How can we avoid duplication? Should we be funding three different departments to address drinking water issues? Maybe, but maybe that creates some bureaucracy and duplication that might not be necessary. So taking a look at how can we be effective and efficient as possible as a state government. And that may involve, you know, more staff, more permanent staff, if drought is the new normal, to try and set up some of these structures so that we are being more proactive and prepared to coordinate across all of the different areas of state government that need to be involved. The third point here is one I mentioned earlier, but really thinking as a legislature, how you want to balance your long-term response to future droughts with those pressing needs. And those large water supply projects and investments, while important and essential to drought preparedness, aren't as effective in immediate drought response. So thinking about what are your goals and what are the appropriate funding sources and types of project to address those goals, whether they are short-term response and long-term response. And that leads to the fourth point there about the fund sources and thinking about if you want, what we saw during the last drought was that for some of those immediate responses, emergency responses, because of its flexibility, general fund is often the best fit. And on that point, I just want to mention, I know this isn't the budget committee, but want to be sure that all the members have on their radar. Our office put out a report a couple of weeks ago on the state appropriations limit, which is a new factor that's going to become an increasing issue in budgetary decisions and will place some limitations, even as we face a historic surplus, on how the state can spend some of that funding. So I won't go into detail on it here unless there are questions I'm happy to address, but just something we want to be sure you are thinking about. There are some types of expenditures that are not subject to that limit, and then some that are. So as you're thinking about how to respond effectively and how to use the state funding that's available, that will become a factor. The next point here, ongoing drinking water challenges become compounded during droughts. I think that was one of the big highlights from the last drought. We do have a new funding source and a new program to address drinking water issues, but I think we should all be prepared, and the state should really have as one of its primary areas of focus in the coming months and years that is likely to be another resurging problem is drinking water issues. That leads to the next point, that rural and vulnerable communities are particularly affected by drought. We saw this during the last drought, not just from drinking water, but also economic impacts from agricultural slowdowns in production, for example. And we know that low-income communities of color also face disproportionate impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic, and so are already struggling. So as we think about how the state's going to respond and where to target its assistance, thinking about what communities might need that assistance the most as they face additional challenges. Second to last point here on fish and wildlife, just the reminder that the state has the responsibility to protect public trust resources, such as fish, wildlife, and waterways on behalf of the public. So as we think about our priorities and our drought response, we are going to have to balance human needs as well as environmental needs. And one of those environmental impacts that really was highlighted during the last drought was an unprecedented number of dead trees, which then contributed to more severe and intense wildfires, which likely the state should be prepared to see whether this summer and in the coming years if drought conditions continue.
That's our show for today. If you have a topic you'd like me to keep an eye on, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.